everybody. This is a session called It's Your Money. Welcome to the Atomic Audit. Some of you, I think, maybe are new in the village since these sessions have started. This is the third one in the series. My name is Jonathan Ferrix. I work for the World Council of Churches. And you can read the opening there for a little more information. Nice to see you on such a beautiful evening. I want to say a caveat first. I actually hate this saying, it's your money. I think it's actually driven us into the ditch where we pretend that we have all the rights to our own money and we don't need to think about the common good. Our government is bad, it's wasting our money, it's your money, and it's grossly misused in our society. But if you want to use it correctly, use it on something like the nuclear weapons budget, because that is an extreme misuse of your money. And by the end of the session, you'll have some of these ideas. You'll have an understanding of the math behind something called the atomic audit. You'll have some explanations. Nothing explains it adequately because this is I've been saying nuclear weapons are kind of a collective insanity. Paying for them is an even deeper form of insanity. I'm going to talk a little bit about two traditions that have justified our use of nuclear weapons, but also our view of the world as a great power and as a rising power in the last 250 years. And traditions in Western political thought of dominance versus consent. And then finally, ways we haven't spent so much money that are eminently more useful for us and for other people. And you get into planetary scale remedies if you talk about the kind of money that we're using to in the history of nuclear weapons. And I've got one right here that I'm just, can I call that sheet up?
Yep.
The one you just had. Somebody want to pull, it's up. We've had a little trouble getting up the file with the atomic audit on it, so I'm going to spend my time at the beginning doing the last part. What else can we spend such money on? These are the Millennium Development Goals, which, let me just, please, can I do some audience research? How many people have heard of the Millennium Development Goals? Okay. In 2000, as the millennium started, I what did you do for the millennium? I came to Holden and went powder skiing up in Big Creek, you know, January 1st, 2000. Couldn't think of a better place to pass the millennium. You were here too?
No, I went to Disneyland.
Well, should we stop the session and do a little psychotherapy here? What did the millennium tell us about your interests? Anyway, a really cool thing happened. Virtually every head of state in the world got together in New York and had a millennium summit and set out goals, not for the millennium, just for the first 15 years, up to 2015. And I have to say, this stuff is going on all the time, but where you live, the news never percolates through. So every country in the world sat down and basically said, oh yeah, we believe in this. Solemnly, you know, swear, put your hand on your heart. Our country will help, your country will. But they said it, you know, and in this world, that's as good as you get at some point. So there are the eight goals. Look at that. Halve the proportion of people with less than $1 a day by 2015. The first one, eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. Extreme poverty defined as the billion people who live on a dollar a day. Okay, second one, have the proportion of people who suffer from hunger. They go together, all right? Second one, achieve universal primary education. What's that? Ensure that boys and girls alike, girls alike, big issue there, complete primary schooling. Third one, promote gender equality and empower women. And that, for the specific, it says eliminate gender disparity at all levels of education. Education only. You can deal with gender equity in educational settings, as we know. Fourth, reduce child mortality. Reduce by two-thirds the under-5 mortality rate. Anybody know how many kids die per day in the world of totally preventable causes? Absolutely no reason for them to die. It used to be a figure, now it's a slightly different figure. It's actually getting a little better. Anybody know what it is?
50,000.
It was 40,000 when I was working in Lutheran World Relief. Now it's down to 35,000. Children a day die from dirty water, lack of vaccination, modest
diarrhea
caused by, I mean, totally preventable things, absolutely preventable. Improve maternal health, I was going to say mental health, it's probably the same thing. Reduce by 3/4 the maternal mortality ratio. Big deal. How many mothers die in childbirth? You know, you can get, in this country, it's 1 in 1,000. You have countries where it's 1 in 100. Afghanistan is first on the list. Combat HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases. Probably tuberculosis, third on the list. Reverse the spread. So no longer increasing spread, just turn it back. These are all smart goals. You can, you know, specific, measurable, all that stuff. Ensure environmental sustainability. Integrate sustainable development into country policies and reverse loss of environmental resources. Just integrate it into the policies. Doesn't mean do much good, but get it started, you know. Halve the proportion of people without access to potable water. Huge. Very definite. Significantly improve the lives of at least 100 million slum dwellers. You know, urbanization, half the world living in cities now. Most of them are fresh, the poorest ones are fresh from the countryside. And finally, develop a global partnership for development. Raise official development assistance, expand market access, encourage debt sustainability. In other words, don't bother, don't push people to borrow too much. Does it open on that? Okay, sorry. All right. Thank you, Mark, for trying. Anyway, these goals were signed by everybody. We're more than 2/3 of the way towards them. I haven't seen the latest report card on how we're doing, but I don't think we're going to make it to those goals. They were not crazy. They're totally doable. But for many different reasons, we're probably going to be disappointed. We're moving on it, but we're going to be disappointed.
Are you saying, Jonathan, it's lack of funding of the programs to achieve?
Certainly lack of funding, lack of governmental modification of programs and commitments of government's own programs. Governments have to upgrade their capacity. Civil society has to get involved. The whole thing has to be marked. They're going to review them now, I think, at the General Assembly in September, where we're at. But this is, you know, Lutheran World Relief and any agency you support, World Vision, anything you support, Heifer Fund, this is what they're working on. And it's absolutely not rocket science. If these changes, this is one of my favorite statistics, if these changes had not happened in the USA in the first, at the turn of the century, 19th century, 100 years ago, your grandparents and great-grandparents, half of the Americans today that are alive would not be alive because your grandparent would have died instead of lived because they didn't have indoor plumbing and they didn't have vaccinations. It's as simple as that. If you hadn't had indoor plumbing and vaccinations, half of us would not be here just 100 years ago. So is this out of touch in a world with our capacity? Absolutely not. It's piece of cake, literally. Difficult, obviously, but not impossible. Well, what I wanted to point it out was, have this in mind, because while we've tried to get this other program, thank you. It's okay. The bad news I had on that USB key just deteriorated in the wonderful fresh mountain air. So I can't share it with you directly, I have to show you the pictures. But keep this figure in mind. This is the World Bank's best estimate. What does achieving these goals cost? $40 to $60 billion. In addition to foreign aid. So foreign aid at present is, I think, about $15 billion a year worldwide.
U.S.
Yeah, not US. Just U.S. aid. All aid.
Oh, all foreign
28,
aid.
20 billion. It's not this much.
Government to government.
All aid from the private sector does it.
Private.
Peanuts. Peanuts. World Vision's a billion. ACT is a billion. The Action by Churches Together, 1.5 billion maybe. But 40 to 60 billion would achieve this, which would be like accelerating from current development to rocket mode, you know, jet assisted takeoff. 40 to 60 billion a year from 2000 to 2015. Any questions about what I'm trying to put across here as a little bracket for our session? Millennium Development Goals. It's interesting to read up about them. Follow them in the news. See if you can find them. If you're really a rebel, call your television station and say, why don't you guys ever tell us about this stuff? They won't know what they are either, but... Yeah.
What about the countries like Afghanistan and some of those that abuse women and don't want to educate the girls and everything? Are they in favor of this too?
They signed it.
They signed it?
Well, Afghanistan was, at this point, Afghanistan is run by the Taliban. They didn't sign it. But they may have done. When you get them all together, they all want to speak up for the right thing. It's just like you guys. Nobody wants to. This morning we learned none of us would stand here and take off our clothes. So, you know, this is important.
But the government, some of those governments are so corrupt that they're inadequate to do anything.
Well, that's beside the point.
That's a small, 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 small minority. It would never stop us from achieving. Okay, let's just say Afghanistan is totally out to lunch. They don't ever take part. You can still achieve the goals in every other country or most other countries. That the exceptions do not remove the potential for the general challenge. And I think what better way to mark a millennium, certainly the first time in human history, where humanity got together and said, gee whiz, you know, it just ain't right to have a billion people living on $1 a day. There's actually 2 billion people, I think, living on $2 a day, if you raise it just one by a dollar. Anyway, I'm going to go from this to the, as I said in my description of this session, just in case you didn't read it, never in human history, with apologies to Winston Churchill, has so much been spent by so few in such secrecy on something so dangerous and unusable. And we're still paying for more? Imagine the alternatives. This is the alternatives. Because this figure becomes very important right here, $55 billion. Becomes very important after you see what the audit said. Any other questions on this one before we turn this off? Yes? Maybe turn off the projector if you could. If somebody could, it's on the top on your left as you face. Okay. Is there a bit more light we can have?
Press it once more.
That's. I think if you push the.
Do I hold it down?
You have to just press it twice.
Press it twice, maybe. Yeah. Now
it's on. There it's gone.
Michael, would you mind turning on a few more of these lights? Because I'm going to have to show you the atomic audit on a printout. This is really. This is really.
I don't think there are any more lights.
Well, I'll stand under this one. This is going to be a little bit bad, but you'll get the main idea. From 1990, I think 97 to 2001, or a little bit later, 4 or 5 people from civil society, I mean non-governmental people, sat down and did the atomic audit. So the costs and consequences of U.S. nuclear weapons since 1940. And if you want to remember a man's name, Stephen Schwartz, he's the editor of the Non-Proliferation Review. You could Google atomic audit and see the slides that I'm going to show you in this wonderful low-tech way. Just that a file was corrupted. I don't know why. But can anybody see that there are different colors on the pie chart? All right. I'll give you the major items. What do you think the big red one is? This is total costs. Well, let me start with this one. The magic number? $5.8 trillion.
Is this U.S. money?
Just U.S. and just U.S. nuclear weapons. Not what the Russians spent, not what the French, the Chinese, the British, Israelis, Indians, Pakistanis.
So all of this is about weapons? It's not...
Nuclear weapons.
Oh, okay.
What we spent on nuclear weapons is $5.8 trillion.
That's a whole circle.
And since 1940.
In 50 years, and I gotta help you and me to remember, what is $5.8 trillion?
All right. It's real money.
Yeah. It's real money.
Sure is.
Would it be 5,800 million? No, billion.
It's 5 with 12 zeros after it.
It's a lot.
Right? 5 with 12 zeros after it. 5.8. And 11 zeros. So how much is 5.8 trillion? If you stacked the $5.8 trillion up in $1 bills, okay, $1 bills, how, where would it get you?
The moon?
You're in the right direction.
Further?
Further than the moon.
Oh, really?
Mars?
You're being a little bit too sharp for this class. Yeah, I think it said it would go to the moon and back. In single dollar bills. All right? Yeah, here's another one. If you attempted to count $5.8 trillion at the rate of $1 bill a second, so you're not like those guys that flick the money with their thumbs. One, two, three. How long would it take you to get to a million?
Years.
At that rate. 12 days?
5 weeks.
12 days. Okay. How long? It would take you 32 years to reach the first billion. And it would take you 31,700 years to reach the first trillion, and it would take you 184,579 years, so roughly 200,000 years to reach 5.8 trillion. To put it another way, it's $21,000 from every man, woman, and child in America, and we've given that to our nuclear weapons stable. So the red money is deploying the bomb. In other words, it's interesting because the yellow, this little one, 7%, is building the bomb. Everybody says it's not that expensive to build a bomb. But to deploy it, you spend more than half of your total budget. And then the other ones, I'll just do the main colors. Targeting and controlling is 14%. And defending the bomb is 16%, defending it so somebody doesn't take it from you.
What's the advertising cost?
Yeah, they don't have any. It's secret. But secret Pentagon programs are 20% more expensive than non-secret programs. And this is one of them.
Why do they keep doing it?
Well, that's why you're here at this session. Tell me if you don't agree with the reasons by the end. Dismantling, so far, has been this 0.5, half a percent. The green is nuclear waste management, very modest. They should have spent a lot more than this. Go to Hanford and ask what's happening there. Nuclear secrecy, 0.5%. Anyway, you get the idea.
Could you elaborate on what the deploying is? Is that?
Putting them in a place where you can use them, sticking them on top of the missiles, having it at the Air Force bases, putting in the submarines, putting the submarine in the water, keeping in the water,
building
all the stuff.
Building the silos, I suppose.
Building the silos, yeah.
Maintaining staff.
Well, it's production. You know, it costs so much to design, to research, and to develop the weapon, and then it goes into production.
No, that's on the 7%.
Oh, really?
Building the bomb is part of the 7%. Building the bomb, 7%. 55 to deploy. This is the absolute most important. Sorry, question?
Well, I just, on that huge red figure there,
yeah.
And I don't want to take anything away from the absurdity of this cost, but if we didn't have nuclear weapons, they were never developed, we would have incurred some of those costs by maintaining traditional military.
I have your answer in the next slide.
Okay.
Ready? I'm really sorry, but let me just draw you the first three bars. Can you see the blue and the red?
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, here's the blue, the first blue. I've got good eyes, you know, I can draw stories, things exactly like they look. That's the second blue. And then here's the first red, the red. It comes up to about there. That's red or purple. And I'll just do two more blues to give you a little bit, three more blues to give you some perspective. Here's a blue. Here's a blue. And here's a blue. And then we're getting into little stuff. Small change. Guess what this is? I'll give you the clue. This is the nuclear.
Is this still money? Are you talking about money?
Sorry, yeah. Money in 50 years. What has Uncle Sam spent yours and mine and his money on in 50 years, from 46 to 96? Or 40 to 96, actually.
So it includes the Second World War.
I think it must, yeah. I know it does on the nuclear side, but
You said 46?
Sorry, no, this is 46 to 96.
46
to 96.
Post-war.
So post-war.
They had, sorry, elsewhere in the study, they tell you how much the Manhattan Project cost. Mm-hmm. And it was like 83% enrichment. The stuff Iran's trying to do now, the whole Manhattan Project that got us to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, 83% enrichment cost. So what's this?
Interest?
No.
Enrichment.
Real spending. No, no. This is the nuclear budget here. What other things Uncle Sam spends? This is your federal budget.
Well, personnel.
Defense.
No,
Defense.
This is, I'll say yes when somebody shows the right answer. This is defense spending without nuclear weapons costs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Conventional weapons.
Okay.
And personnel.
Yeah, all the costs.
Military force.
Not federal budget. Yeah. This is Uncle, if you had the whole graph, this is Uncle Sam's budget.
Yeah.
Audit for 50 years.
It's always been defense.
So that bar is like three times $5.8 trillion?
Yeah, it's $13.2 trillion. On Pentagon without nukes.
Yeah.
Second one, what do you think this is? It's half, just a little over half of this.
Social Security.
We have smart people in the balcony. $7.8 trillion. All right? This is nuclear, 5.8. You saw it up there. So nuclear, all by itself, it should really be here. But they broke it out to just to show exactly the issue that is troublesome. 5.8 trillion for nuclear. The next one, income security. That must mean welfare and all kinds of income support programs from the federal government. Quite high. Yeah, unemployment. Unemployment is probably the biggest one, actually. But the federal government doesn't play unemployment, does it?
No, state.
But how much federal work?
For
I don't know. I could look up what it meant. But this is 4.7. Medicare. We have any old people in the room? 4.7 trillion on Medicare. No, sorry. Interest on the national debt.
Oh, that's the interest.
Oh. Watch this one grow. And then here's Medicare. So, you know, what does all this have to do with our faith? Well, a lot, I think. But if this was a household and we were Christians, could you put your foot inside the door of a church? If that was where your money went?
What would our health care be?
Yeah.
Well, and it's not just your health care, it's everybody's health care. You know, the first thing on here, well, Social Security is good. So I give this a Christian star. I give this one a Christian star. I'm not sure about the rest of it. And what are you interested in? Veterans benefits? That's the next one after Medicare, $1.8 trillion. The next one after that is health, $1.7 trillion. Then transportation, $1.5 trillion. And they're here in little tiny, and it goes way on up. Anybody?
Where's the education?
Oh, way down.
So the transportation includes?
$1.5.
Is it education?
Education, training, employment, and social services, all of the above, $1.5 trillion.
That's just the federal budget, not local.
It's just the federal budget.
Right, right.
But that's the biggest chunk of my taxes. I think it's the biggest chunk of your taxes. So this is the main thing to keep in mind. We won't go into all of the details with these little... you just can't see it. But this is how big were the stockpiles. The red one is the Russians, and the blue one, which goes like this, is ours. But it's not going to show very well. Megatonnage of the U.S. nuclear response. Same thing. Rockets. This is 55. Little tiny megatonnage, and then boom, by 1960, we're at the biggest explosive power we ever had. And then it drops off. Tests. The U.S. has done more tests. We got the blue lines here. The U.S. has done more tests than all the rest of the world's nuclear powers put together. 1,000 of them, 250 of which were in the atmosphere, 785 underground. Here's a picture of the Nevada test site. Anybody been out there? You can go as a tour. You have? Yeah. I'll pass it around. In fact, I'll pass the whole thing around if you're interested. But all these little bumps are where they did an underground nuclear explosion, and you get a kind of a collapse. It looks like an ant line. You know what ant lines are? Gigantic ant lines that could trap dinosaurs. But And then here's just some pictures of different kinds of nukes. And this is my favorite. It's called Davy Crockett. It's a Jeep with a guy holding what looks like a giant bazooka. And it's actually a shoulder-launched nuclear weapon, which the Army had for a while. And if you read the details, it went between 2 and 5 kilometers. So it went to like the far end of the campground to maybe halfway to Hart. And then it blew up, and God help the crew who launched it. Because I think it was, you know, as near as to a suicide squad as you could imagine. These are too detailed to help right now. But we'll try these. How did this happen? So Stephen Schwartz and his team, with 4 years of work, they have a lot more verbiage, and I have the whole part of a summary of the report. But arbitrary decision making, that's how it happened. Second one, fear and inadequate intelligence, that's how it happened. How much would the Russians actually have? We better build a lot just in case they have what we fear they might have. Faulty beliefs, a bigger bang for the buck. The idea that all of the services could have nuclear weapons instead of regular weapons, because proportionally you get more bang for your buck if you build a nuclear weapon, especially if you look just at the building cost. That's not so horrendous if you don't count the rest of the cost. Congressional demands for more weapons. And then inter-service and intra-service rivalry. Schwartz says there wasn't one nuclear arms race. There were four. We were racing the Russians, right? But the Army was racing the Air Force was racing the Navy, and the Navy was racing the Marines. Whatever I didn't say.
Marines.
No, I don't think they had any. They're too tough, you know, they don't get Air Force, Army, Navy. Everybody's racing each other, and there was none of these figures were known to anybody. I mean, some were known within the service, but no totals were known when they did this. They had to add this up. The government had not ever accounted for its nuclear weapons. Redundant targeting. We seem to feel like we needed lots of bombs on a given place. Yeah, here's the Davy Crockett. So, the other thing is, pork barrel politics. And you guys benefited by it a lot, I think, with Warren Magnuson and what was the other guy?
Jackson.
Hanford, all that stuff. That's before them, I think, but a lot came to Washington. this is an aerial photo. I'll pass it around. But when Russians realized they couldn't keep up with us, they could not spend anything like this kind of money, but they wanted to be a superpower opposite us, so they went to radar defense and anti-missile defense around Moscow and other major centers. And every 5 miles around the way out in the countryside around Moscow, they have what they call pillbox radar stations. This is from Google Earth, and it shows you a pillbox radar station. It's like the size of a big aircraft hangar. You could put a 747 inside. At the height of the nuclear armaments race, there were 46 nuclear weapons targeted on one of these pillbox radar stations. We simply did not have enough targets, so we just started to put multiple targets on one thing. And one bomb, way, way more powerful than Hiroshima. But we have 46 on one pillbox. It's hard to believe.
Does that mean that just because we had all those targets, if there was a war and someone pushed a button, would every missile be deployed?
All the ones on high alert, which is usually several thousand, absolute more overkill. Yeah, every target would be hit in the high alert status.
By every missile.
Yeah, I have details on something called the Single Integrated Operations Plan, and it was from the height of the Cold War. And they would wipe out virtually all of Eastern Europe, Russia, USSR, and China. If Russia attacked us, they were going to do them all. At that point, at that point, they figured 300 million people will die. If they strike us, we're going to respond before the missiles arrive. This is launch out warning. And we're going to take out 300 million communists.
How do you have this information? Isn't it still...
No.
It's disclosed?
Yeah, it's disclosed. How did this happen? Nuclear weapons were free goods for the military service. Why? Because they weren't built by the Pentagon. The weapons themselves are all built by the Department of Energy and its predecessors, the Atomic Energy Commission. So they were built on a different budget, which they had to go to and find, you know, the money for that too. Failure to correctly anticipate Soviet reaction to U.S. deployments. There's a lot of details there, but it added to the amount spent. Extreme secrecy. I said earlier they've done a study, and if a program is secret, it's 20% more expensive than a program that's not secret. I can't explain it very well. Pork barrel politics and domestic economic factors. Don't underestimate the jobs for the defense contractors involved in this and the people who are providing the services. The intangible costs, health impacts of U.S. nuclear testing. Any Mormons among us? Mormons have a special issue here because they're downwind of the Nevada test site, a lot of them. And there are a lot of missiles to be placed under that Minuteman system where the missiles are really on trains that never stop moving. That was in a lot of Mormon-owned property as well. So Mormons do not like this program, and they're suffering it in their bodies through increased cancer rates. Consequences for U.S. nuclear weapons workers. I haven't mentioned the Pacific Islanders. I haven't mentioned, you know, other people, obviously. The Tahitians under the French. 600,000 people have worked in nuclear weapons facilities of the U.S. The payments to them are rather modest compared to the cancers and things that they've contracted from being around that much radiation. You can see these pictures, it's really dramatic to see them blown up on the screen, but maybe some of you had first-hand contact. You know, there's several thousand soldiers standing in the open watching this test. And in a sense, they were being used as experiment subjects because you weren't going to get killed, but there was a lot of attention paid to what were the effects. Here's some pictures of the workers. Intangible costs, environmental contamination, secrecy and loss of public trust in government. And then here's Hanford, low-level waste disposal trench, circa 1950s. So low-level radioactive waste, just in a kind of a slit trench in the fine state of Washington, Columbia Valley. Here's Idaho National Laboratories. Disposal of plutonium contaminated waste, 1960. So they're in barrels, just tip them over the hill and then push some dirt over. Lessons learned. Early assumptions on costs of nuclear weapons were wrong. Nuclear insurance policy flawed and dangerous. The idea that nuclear weapons would give you insurance, they actually just made you want and made you do more. Cold War outcome does not justify or rationalize the process. The idea that nuclear weapons kept the peace. That's almost gospel truth among many, many people. Wait a minute, didn't they keep the peace for 50 years? Well, think about that. There's a lot of reasons why. It's not a very convincing argument. I've got a couple of them to talk about later. U.S. government has never had an accurate, comprehensive picture of the total, cumulative, or annual costs of the U.S. nuclear weapons program. Now, to connect it with what we showed earlier for the development goals, let's just stick with the money for a while, and then we'll go back to the you can just pass these around one by one if you like.
Has anybody in the government seen this report at all?
Oh, yeah, no, they give it in Washington all the time. We brought the guy over to Geneva and put it on for all the governments of the world to see as a way to use our money.
And what's the response?
It's interesting. Diplomats have an interesting life, you know, because they have to put up with all kinds of stuff that isn't good. But it has to change back in the capital, and the capital will tell you it has to change in the people's hearts. You know, I mean, this is a U.S. problem, too, so the rest of the world can say, we're not surprised. We know how crazy this has been.
Can I ask a dollars question?
Please, this is what we're doing.
So setting aside for a minute, because you said you were going to come back to the rebutting the argument that it kept the peace mm-hmm. for 50 years.
Yeah.
Many argue that one of the reasons the Soviet Union collapsed was because it was just bankrupted trying to keep up with the U.S. arms race. And so what do time, it brought about the peaceful demise of someone our country deemed a threat and an enemy. That by spending $5.8 trillion, it may not, the goal in some ways may not have been to build all of these nuclear weapons, although I think in many people's minds it was, but that to drive the
nobody knew we were spending that amount.
Fair enough. But what we did know was that by spending a lot of money on defense and offensive weaponry, whether nuclear or not, it was forcing the Soviet Union to respond as best they could. And in the process, it would appear bankrupted itself. They devoted so much of their economy to this that they left their people even worse off than our people for all that we spent. So I'm just curious.
Well, as we ended the Cold War.
I beg your pardon?
And ended the Cold War.
Precisely. So it seems to me as you evaluate that cost, I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are when you look at it from that perspective.
Well, I want to read you what Stephen...
Since the end of the Cold War, though.
Pardon?
What have we spent since the end of the...
Another $2 trillion on nuclear alone. So we're up to 7.5 now. So this is actually very interesting. It plays right into what I had planned. I wasn't smart enough to think that until just now. But I'm going to come to that, because it doesn't matter that we bankrupted them. We're just spending at the same rate. So what does that say? I'll put that out there first. I'll read Stephen Schwartz's paragraph answering the question. The argument that nuclear weapons were the key to keeping the Cold War cold, and that whatever was spent on them was therefore a sound investment, is also flawed. First, nuclear weapons were not the sole means of keeping the peace, or when deemed necessary, fighting wars. We didn't use them against the Soviet Union. We fought a lot of wars against the Soviet Union, proxy wars. We used other weapons. The United States built a large conventional arsenal too. We had huge superiority of conventional weaponry, globally at least. Spending 2.5 times more money on conventional weapons than on nuclear weapons during the Cold War. Would that have been enough to bankrupt them? I think so. They couldn't keep up with us in any category. See, we're picking a particularly wild category to prove that we're richer and we're willing to spend more to get somewhere where you can get a lot of other ways than through an arms race.
But my point was that if you set aside what they're spending the money on, just the idea of getting them to spend the money.
Yeah, but this is just not nothing. I mean, this has huge consequences.
No, I appreciate that. But that is sort of a separate discussion about the other consequences of having all these nuclear weapons. I do agree with that.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, here it is. Second, the nuclear program, unbounded as it was by logic or cost, this is Stephen Schwartz, he's not a radical, led to all sorts of weapons that contributed little or nothing to deterrence, such as the nuclear-powered aircraft. Did you know we worked on one of those? $7 billion for a nuclear-powered aircraft. Pluto, a nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed cruise missile. The MX racetrack scheme, the one the Mormons got a lot of easements taken out of their ranches for. The Aster, an anti-submarine nuclear torpedo guided to its target by a wire. A nuclear torpedo? Ensuring that upon detonation it would destroy not only the Soviet submarine, but also the U.S. submarine that launched it. Finally, such arguments ignore the great risks posed by the nuclear postures we maintain, postures that exactly could have triggered the very war we sought to avoid. You could say that the nuclear instability and the fact that we were saved from ourselves for 50 years by none of the accidents turning into an actual war, the worst being the Cuban Missile Crisis, negates the argument all by itself, because to pick something so risky to try to beat them was like the wildest poker scheme in history. So, but what's striking is how powerful that argument is. I hear it all the time. We hear it from governments all the time. All the nuclear powers use it. Wait a minute, don't get so excited about getting rid of these things. They kept the peace.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point, but I'm not making the point that they kept the peace and therefore were justified. Just that they...
What's the difference?
Huge expenses, and it was the expense that bankrupted the Soviet Union. To me, that's a...
But that got us to something that was supposed to be like peace. You know, we stopped the Cold War. So,
yeah,
they go together.
Had we had another way to cause them to spend $5.8 trillion, we may have accomplished the same thing without necessarily...
It's a totally different class, but there are 1,000 other paths we could have taken through the Cold War. Instead of this one, that are are way more likely to end it and bring us into some kind of stability, you know, rather than this extremely expensive and dangerous path.
Yeah, well, the danger part is indisputable, I agree
with
that.
Thanks for the question. Let me just go to that, maybe, that part that I alluded to a second ago, and have a look at the paper that's coming around to see the nice colors and things on the graphs. But I wanted to just spend a little bit of time on the easiest way to say, why do we spend this money? Well, we thought we had a lot of enemies, or we thought we had an enemy, or we didn't develop the nuclear weapons without enemies in mind. And this is basically our list. There are six. So it started, and each time that you change enemies, change reasons for having these weapons, you change the not only the enemy, the target, but you change the rationale, because the first rationale doesn't fit the second doesn't fit the third. So we started getting them because rumor had it, and a bit of intelligence that wasn't too accurate had it, that the Nazis were working on it. And you could imagine any government fighting the Germans and thinking the Germans with nuclear weapons, God help us, you know. So we started a program to deny them a monopoly of this super weapon. Remember, who was it who pointed out in like 1938 that this is what would happen? If you could split the atom, you would have an explosive force like nothing anybody ever dreamed of. And the Germans were working on it. Where did we get all our good scientists from after the war? We grabbed about 200 of them. The Russians grabbed about 50 of them. And they worked for us ever since, and they worked for the Russians ever since. But meanwhile, Germany didn't really have a very developed program. It didn't look like a logical threat. So our program was well underway. We just switched it over to Japan. But to say you wanted to deny them a nuclear monopoly didn't make sense, because Japan didn't have a program. So if you keep your weapons and you switch your enemy and your target and your reason for these weapons to Japan, you're inviting yourself into the territory of what's called first use. In nuclear strategy debates to this day, one thing that the non-nuclear weapon states ask of the nuclear powers and say, please sign this paper that says you won't use these weapons against us. And an even broader sense of security is created if a power agrees never to use a weapon first. And China has done that. China has a no first use policy. Now you could say those tricky guys, they're just doing that because they're behind us. Maybe it's true. But it's still, the policy has a lot of power to the vast majority of the world who are not nuclear weapons armed. No first use. It gives you some sense of security in a rather crazy situation. But if you pick Japan as your enemy in the middle of late in World War II, you're gonna do first use. So you're using this thing that is what? And when it shifted from here to here, there's a really interesting footnote. Building it because of Hitler was easy to sell within the few people who knew about it and to the scientists who had to do the work to make it credible. When you shifted to Japan, only one scientist pulled out, saying, wait a minute, I'm not working on this to stop the Japanese. I was working on this because of the Nazis. And that's a guy named Joseph Rothblatt. And if you want to read, a really interesting guy who protested the rest of his life, Polish scientist named Joseph Rothblatt. Everybody else continued to work on the project, the Manhattan Project, despite the change in the dramatic change in what they were doing it for. And Richard Feynman, you've seen his books, right? He was involved, and he said, we started for a good reason, meaning Nazis. But soon the work, the drive to do something, to accomplish it, took over. So although after you thought at the beginning, later you said you could just stop, you weren't able to stop. And Jonathan Schell's comment is, it wasn't the last time that the bomb stopped thought. It wasn't the last time that the bomb stopped thought. And I'm reading you something from this book, which I said the other day I had ordered, but the order didn't get here. And if you want to buy a good book, I'm sure it's in paperback now. Jonathan Schell, The Seventh Decade, and it's produced by Metropolitan Books. Excellent examination of the seventh decade of the nuclear era. So when we use them against Japan, what do? Even before we use them, we went to target three. Roosevelt and Truman were thinking what advantage this would give them after the war, because it was clear that they weren't just going to have a lovey-dovey relationship with the Soviet Union after they got done with their common enemy. And they switched to, started switching to the idea that the Russians were the card. And Secretary of War Stimson advised Roosevelt not to go to Potsdam, or Truman rather, not to go to the summit meeting at Potsdam shortly before the end of the war, when they planned the ending of the war, and they planned the, they got, that's where they got into the division of Europe and all the stuff which we lived with then for 50 years. He said, don't go to Potsdam until you've got in your pocket confirmation that the bomb actually works. So the Trinity test we heard about this morning, that happened. Truman took the news and he told Stalin, oh, by the way, we have this weapon. Well, Stalin already knew from spies, but they wanted to be at Potsdam with the sense that they had this ace of all aces in their back pocket, and letting Russia know that after the war, be careful with what you do. When the Russians started their program, they got into a very similar mentality, and Schell says, neither the Soviet or the American leaders were shy about saying, we've got something here that can endanger civilization and even the continued existence of human beings. But to justify that, you have to give a really good reason. So for us, it was the threat that the communists posed in our minds to ourselves, but also to freedom worldwide. So you have the bomb because you're protecting freedom worldwide. You have to reach for the biggest thing you can think of to justify such a thing, even though nobody knew how much you're spending, and many people didn't know the full capacity of what you were doing. The United States was eager to live in a world free of nuclear weapons, but was prevented from doing so by the Soviet Union, which, owing to its totalitarian system, rejected the sorts of inspections that would be necessary for any abolition to work. Get that? Nice reasoning there? We can't give them up because the Russians will never let us inspect them to prove that they're not doing it on the sly. And every single piece of the nuclear history and how the bomb spread to all the different countries is full of that kind of logic. We don't really want to have this, but we have to because these guys are so tricky. And if they have it, we've got to have it. And that's how it works between all the pairings that you've got. When the Soviet Union sort of liquidated itself with a little help from racing us in ways that they couldn't, but I don't really think they would have lasted too long either if you ever visited those countries. You have an issue here because your former rival is gone, and suddenly possession of nuclear arms no longer required any large, deeply considered, publicly saleable political or moral justification. The war was over. Who kept their weapons? We did. The Russians did. So did everybody else. The Cold War was gone, but the weapons continued. And possession became acceptable even with no enemy in the field. And his next line is, this was a lesson attended to closely by India, by Pakistan, by Iran, and by North Korea, and other nations who did not want to be without nuclear weapons in a nuclear-armed world. But George Bundy, a high-level advisor back in the 70s and 60s, I think, pointed out, nuclear arsenals, even when unaccompanied by specific threats, have a language all their own. They say, here's what the bomb says, we are here, we are not going away, we being the bomb. We may not be targeting you right now, but we may in the future, so be careful. And I thought of John's thing the other day. I am here as God is. How does it go? Your three little. Breathe in.
God is. I am here all as well.
Okay, God is. I am here. So God is.
I am here. God
is. I am here. God is all as well. Let's try that. We are here. We're not going away. We may be targeting you right now. But we might not be targeting now, but we may in the future. It's the opposite in every way. It's the devilish opposite of the one you gave us. The fifth and the sixth targets, giving us a reason to spend this kind of money and keep spending it even after 20 years after the Cold War, really become the first, this one, all purpose. We don't even need the enemies. We just have these for various reasons. But rogue states, I mean, I'm sorry, but the whole term rogue state You could say rogue government, but rogue state with the whole people in the block, it doesn't, it, no leader of any self-respecting country or country that wants to get along with the rogue, call it other countries rogue states. It's almost become a normal term. But go and talk to people from that country and ask them if that does any good whatsoever. But it's used here, and it shows you what good it does with us. It allows us to think that it's a legitimate use of our money and our power. And then finally, what we heard before the Iraq War, Colin Powell's finest, non-finest hour in front of the UN General Assembly, explaining that we had to go to Iraq because of WMD and the threat of weapons of mass destruction. So the reason for having them has actually broadened beyond those who might have a nuclear program to those who have chemical or biological weapons, other weapons of mass destruction. So you have a kind of a mission creep going on from country to country to country, and then more general. And when we get into this zone here is where we get into the big trouble now, because I think two things. One, I have a video I might play part of tomorrow where Henry Kissinger says, and you know Kissinger, he knows everything, right? He says, within 10 years, there'll be a terrorist incident. If we don't get this under control and start going away with the weapons and start going away with the loose nukes that are out there, we're working on it, but it'll never be controlled if we keep building the weapons and keeping them. He said there'll be a terrorist incident with a nuclear weapon, and the cost will be unimaginable. Unimaginable. Worldwide ripples. The second thing is, if we don't start getting rid of them seriously, all the countries you read about as the rising new states that aren't nuclear weapon states, Brazil first, Russia's already got them, China's already got them, India's already got them. If Brazil gets them, Argentina will go for them. South Korea, Taiwan, Japan. You could name 30 countries that could have nuclear weapons relatively quickly. And if that's the standard by which the world's going to run, that's the world we make for ourselves. That's the future we build if we don't think we need to get rid of it. But today's lesson is about how good it is not to spend that money. Now, what do we spend on these for a year? We spend, on nuclear weapons, we spend $55 billion a year. Okay? So $55 billion. Relates to that world, the Millennium Development Goals. It's basically the cost of reaching the goals. So if the U.S., and here's the question to begin our closing thoughts. The U.S. could pay the Millennium Development Goals all by itself if it didn't spend it on nuclear weapons. Now, of course, that's a bit hypothetical. You have to get rid of them. It'll take billions and billions to pull them apart and make them into reactor fuel, blend them down, all that stuff, clean the place up. It's a lot of money to get out of this hole. But let's just pretend what we're spending. We know what we're spending. We could pay the Millennium Development Goals all by yourself. And I say with total sincerity, you want peace in the world? Compare the effect of helping 1 billion people get out of $1 a day, doing that thing about women's equality, universal primary school education, having the number of people who don't have clean water, the most basic thing of all. Would that build peace in the world? Absolutely. Where does conflict come from? Resource fights. Discontent, instability, people in countries who never get a fair shake.
Religion.
Religion to some extent, misused to build it up. And I'm totally sure, and you could probably think about it for yourselves, we could be really the light unto the nations with this kind of money, which we have, if we spend it on the well-being of others, not in a give a throwaway government program mode that we all criticize, in a collaborative, use our savvy, how to build partnerships with other countries and deal with these things. A lot of it's just engineering. Clean water is engineering. Sanitation is engineering. We can do that. We're good at that. So I think that there's an amazing difference between what we've chosen to do for 60 years now and what we could be doing now that the Cold War, which was a difficult period, and we made some big mistakes. It's easy to second guess them now, and I don't want to give that impression. But to me, it's quite convincing to think about building peace instead of preparing for war. There's a saying you've all heard, you want peace, prepare for peace. You want peace, prepare for war? No. You want war? You prepare for war, you get war. You want peace, prepare for peace. Let's spend what time we have. Well, I should stop and ask if there's some more questions, because I've been talking a lot.
Somehow what you're saying sounds wonderful, but it doesn't work that way. You talk about that. We were in Africa and Zambia a few years ago. We saw some areas where they had good leadership, they had wells, they had schools, it was fixed up. But if the leadership was crooked, in many places it is. And you talk about $55 billion, our government has thrown away more than that on all these programs our president has come up with. And so.
Well, and has any government ever done anything properly?
Not very many, no.
I don't agree with you.
But how do we get a dollar more a day to everybody in the world when the governments aren't ready to accept it, or they want to steal it?
Well, I'll give you a copy of this report.
Yeah, talk about the report, I'm challenging. If I can come up with the money personally now and give it to you, do you really think you could disperse that money to the rest of the world and give them clean water and sanitation? I think that the corrupt governments would eat it alive.
I think that in a collaborative way between governments who have publicly stated goals like that, where they take it seriously and they work together, we have this huge USAID. It would be the first thing we turn to in this case. And there's plenty of money that gets spent overseas in a way that has nothing to do with me giving somebody a dollar.
We've sent billions of dollars over there, and the corrupt government has stole the money, and people don't get it anyway.
Sometimes it is not the governments.
The only way to solve these problems is to change human nature. And I don't
agree with you. Are there well-run countries? Are there well-run corporations? Are there well-run households? Absolutely. That's our choice. We have a rather poorly run government ourselves.
You know, you're throwing out all these figures, but we have no idea whether those figures are any more accurate than any other figures.
Okay. Yeah. I accept that. I'll give you a copy of where I got it.
We could spend the billions of dollars on our own healthcare system. We argue over whether we should give healthcare to our own people, with a minor portion of this that we want to use to do what? Kill the whole world off? That's what we're doing. We've got power to kill the world. We're spending all this money to kill the world, and we're arguing about whether it would help people if we gave them a dollar a day. If we gave them $10 a day and we lost $5 a day, and they had a better standard of living, why wouldn't we do that as a Christian country? This is a Christian country. We should try to help as much as we can. We should not try to kill the rest of the world.
Excuse me, though. Our comment wasn't whether we should give it. I think that it is, if we do give it, which I think we would like to, could we get it to them?
We can't not
try.
We can't not try.
I'd just like to say this. We talk as if we're not corrupt.
Yeah.
Is it? What kind of corruption is it to spend $5.8 trillion without any accounting or accountability or publicity? And you and I are voting for these people, and that's what they're doing. Is that not corruption?
No.
I mean, you want to talk about wasting money?
Right now, I happen to have driven quite a few miles in the last few months. And I've seen, you might say, new roads tore up because the government has given them money and they got to spend it. And they're wasting money like hand over fist.
Yeah, but speak to my example, please. $5.8 trillion on something that has done what? Made the world a fearful place. Abused our creativity like nothing has ever abused it before. Gone in the contrary direction of what God wants us to be. Corruption in some small country, it seems to me to be an alibi for doing nothing.
We spent $5 trillion in the last few months.
Some other views?
Just a question that maybe goes in a different direction. What? How do we get the genie back in the bottle? Even if all of the governments that now have nuclear weapons eliminated them, which I would favor, the knowledge of how to develop them is still out there. And it seems to me that once the genie's out of the bottle, you're never going to get it put back in.
No, the laws of physics
on the planet.
The laws of physics are the laws of physics, but it's interesting that under one of the things we haven't done since 1996, we, the U.S., and the whole world's watching us to do this, ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty bans nuclear tests completely. They're not completely banned. Everybody's obeying it, except the North Koreans, but they're not completely banned. For that treaty, there are 300 monitoring stations already built and operating around the world. So the answer is, you spend a sliver of this money, a sliver of it, on verification, on monitoring. You can't hide a nuclear explosion. When North Korea did a very, very modest explosion, the CTBT, this treaty, monitoring stations, way far away, picked it up. They weren't supposed to be able to pick it up. They picked it up. So
and you can't develop the weapon without testing?
Yeah, you can, and you might be able to set it off. But again, what future do you want? The future where we don't try or the future where we try? We have built it. We're smart people. We're made in the image of God. I think it's completely doable. It may not be 100%, but it can be way better than what we have now. The alternative, what we're heading for, and the bigger answer to your question is, the nuclear powers have to leave, and they have to get rid of them, and they have to go to zero. And the best plan for it is, the Russians and the U.S. come down to 1,000 total. Right now there's 23,000 still. When they get to 1,000, they reach out and they take, hello, Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea, would that be shame to...
But we have worked down, we've reduced to some extent,
But we can still destroy the world. We can destroy the world many, many times over.
Oh yeah, I know.
You know, I've got figures here, it's too much detail, but how many nukes you need if you just wanted to try to pretend deterrence was a good idea. And it's as low as 400.
Yeah.
You know, but you all go to the edge together from that point on. So Israel has 300, it reduces 10% of 300. You reduce 10% of the 500 you've got as American. And you arrive at the end, and we'd probably want to be the last one to give ours up, so we'd probably tell the others to go over the edge, and then we'd be so nice, we'd put aside our last one, and then we'd go over the edge. But something like that, it can be done, no question. You need the will, and you need the public interest.
And does this have room for nuclear energy in it?
I'm not talking about nuclear energy, but you can't control, you can't have nuclear energy.
That's right.
Without the same verification that we're talking about for the bomb. So, you all think that we can keep living the way we're living because we'll get nuclear power, if you think that. Yes, possible, but you need verification, inspection of a level we haven't even begun to have. And why don't we have it? Because of the weapons.
Verification with what teeth is always another question.
Yeah. Well, the IAEA, here's a good one for you. Spending money at this rate, the $55 billion a year, we spend more in a day keeping our nuclear weapons polished and oiled.
Ready.
And ready to use on launch on warning than the IAEA budget, you know, the International Atomic Energy Agency, where Mohammed Baradei, the Egyptian director, got the Nobel Prize 2 years ago. We spend more in a day on our oiling and polishing of weapons than the IAEA has to work with in a year. And sir, I'm sorry if I'm too direct with you, but the planet you're living on gives very little money for its own collective needs. All the money is, more and more of the money stays in people's pockets, and in corporations' pockets, and people think government is bad, and they think the overarching needs are bad. So the world you're living in has less for a year of the answer to Chuck's question about what we need to be able to do. We need to be sure. We need to have the right to inspect, live inspections, no warning inspections. The IAEA has some of those rules already. And we need punishment. What happened when North Korea withdrew from the treaty? Nothing. They just left. Nobody said anything. Because we're too all wrapped up in ourselves. And I don't think it's about changing human nature. There are plenty of things that happen well. Look at the modest success that shows the way with landmines, cluster munitions. Here's a good one, laser weapons. Laser weapons were developed to blind an army. They were never built by anybody, as far as we know, because the idea of blinding the enemy soldiers was so objectionable that, you know, what's the image of God in us? I keep asking that question. I think the conscience is a little tiny aftershock of God that's left in us. The human conscience rose up and said, no, laser weapons are not good. Chemical weapons, they banned them in 1925 because of what happened in World War I, where maybe some of your grandfathers, you know, turned into lepers because the clouds of gas were drifting across. We have limits to the barbarity we're willing to put up with. And we need more. Biological weapons, don't even begin to talk about it. You want to get scary? Talk about nanotechnology and what weapons will be like in the future. I think this subject is worth talking about because we've all lived for it. We've lived with it. We've put our money into it. We elect people who keep voting for this stuff, who keep allowing it to be secret, who keep thinking that their pork barrel to bring it home to your state is a good use of their democracy. And yet, we're just starting on something which will be a feature of this century. More and more things that we can do because we have the technology and science, but we mustn't do. So where does that relate? Let's end on a religious thought. I think, you ever heard of us described as co-creators? We're really co-creators with God. We can't deal with the universe, but we have this little planet here, and our stewardship of creation is our co-creation role. And I'm waiting for tomorrow when we're going to hear about ecology of the cross. I think there'll be lots of parallel, lots of different. Please come to Bible study at 9 o'clock, and we'll all be united in some place that we aren't right now with this difficult topic. And my point would be that more and more things will be possible that we mustn't do. And I can think of a lot already. But this is the first one. This is the first one where what we can do can actually threaten our little corner of creation. And we have to learn not to do them. And what kind of a world do you need that would be able to learn and agree and follow through and somehow monitor, not perfectly, but enough? You know, we haven't abolished murder, but, you know, anybody murder here? Anybody here? We have any murderers in the room? 100%? Okay.
Actually, yes.
We got 99.9.
Unless we accept responsibility being part of this, and not, if we don't accept realities of some political realities, some of the corruption you alluded to, the fact that many weapon systems are purposely designed of different components made in all congressional districts, so this pork barreling process, yeah, you know, is enacted. The U.S. does use depleted uranium weapons now in the Middle East.
Yeah.
We have to acknowledge political realities that we good church people can say, oh, this is terrible, how can anybody do this? But the reality is, we each are not sending $1 and $2 million to our Congress people to get their attention. I don't know what the answer is exactly, but defense contractors are giving them zillions of dollars. And so, who's a congressperson going to most likely listen to? These good, nice church people say killing is wrong, this is wrong. You know, we need to be alert to.
We need to get the best.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody. And if we didn't